Three, two, one. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour with your host, Luke Jim, and Mr. 1001 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics, take callers, and get you ready to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Welcome, everyone, once again to the Authority Smashing Hour, your favorite show on the internet. And we're back here with Eric. How you doing, Eric?
Good, Mr. 1001 Nights. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, so I just watched this Chomsky interview on the BBC, and the man is about, you know, in his 80s, and he's still dealing with these people pretty well. I think he does, because they all sort of throw the same things at him. Like, they're so predictable, and they'll say things like, "Well, you know, how can you criticize America? People come over here to because it's the land of opportunity, you know." And they sort of like they have all these logical fallacies that they throw at you, and then it's hard to sort of refute them in the space of a few minutes, but he's done it so many times that he's gotten so proficient at it. And I guess that all of us try to learn from those things, because, we always face those sort of rhetorical points. Have you seen how Chomsky usually deals with these kind of interviewers?
Well, yeah, he does get asked the same thing over and over again. What should we do? Do you have any advice for the movement? And he always gets a little annoyed about that. He says, look at what the people in Bolivia are doing. Look at what the people in Haiti are doing. Do they write to me and say, what should we do? No, they go out and do it. You know, they go out and do it, and they probably have never read my books, you know.
Right.
He has said that several times, I've heard him.
I think that, yeah, those kind of questions, I mean, that question in particular you mentioned is more directed at him by activists, but these other questions are more when he's interviewed in the corporate media by what he called commissars, you know, the ideological managers of our society. And basically, you know, they have this sort of totalitarian mentality where they see any country as a monolith. You know, they don't sort of understand that you know, countries have different people, different constituencies that don't share the same interest. So if they say, well, no, how can you criticize the United States when all these things are happening? He said, you know, his answer was, well, look at all these movements. There are different, you know, you have the government and you have these corporations and stuff, and you can't equate those things with the public. There are different. And I think that's standard in sort of like this capitalist statist mentality where it's all a big monolith, and there's no subtlety, there's no distinctions between different, there's no classes, of course, you know, we don't even talk about classes, but yeah, it's so yeah, his answer was, look, first of all, he said, well, yeah, like the reason why the guy was sort of trying to fool him, and he said, well, let me ask you a personal question. I mean, your parents came to America, and they because it was the land of opportunity. So, I mean, how come you criticize the United States if your parents came over here? And he said, first of all, the reason why the U.S. is rich is because, you know, we slaughtered the Native Americans, enslaved the Africans, and, you know, and it became a very rich country. And after that, we've done all these we've engaged in all these actions around the world, which have killed millions of people and so on. And yes, it is a rich country, and people come from those countries here basically to try to get back some of what was stolen from them, because that's most people that come here to. So anyway, I just thought that if you actually analyze what the assumptions are of the questions that you are given in any of these interviews, you understand that their level of intellectual understanding is so low. I mean, they have these very, very authoritarian assumptions about the system. I mean, basically trying to defend the elite system. So, but I just admire the way Chomsky handles these people, because it's not easy. I mean, these people are trained liars.
Attack dogs.
Right. That's basically what they are. But I guess on the subject of propaganda, I was telling you earlier about how I saw on the B. I mean, this interview was on the BBC, but also on the BBC there was this article talking about how the headline was "Textbook Sheds Light on Khmer Rouge Era." Says students can rarely have seemed so enthusiastic about receiving a textbook. So, I mean some students receiving a textbook, deserve such a great attention. I think it's pretty clearly an attempt. It's a political. It has a political purpose. And if you read the article, you can see it because it totally omits the U.S. bombing, which actually led to a lot of the atrocities of the Khmer Rouge, since the Khmer Rouge gained power largely thanks to the bombing of the United States, of that country, which apparently was one of the heaviest bombings in history. And so no mention of that. And of course, they talk about in an attempt to create a socialist utopia or all these things, and it's sort of like it tries to smear any sort of left or radical movement by sort of insinuating or assuming that any effort in that direction, in the direction of equality, in the direction of creating a better society, somehow will lead to this horrible massacre. So, but you were telling me earlier that you actually lived through the era where all of this was bombarded in the media, and so what are your memories of that era?
Well, I remember the genocide that was happening in Cambodia during the time. It was in all the papers. I was young at the time and didn't know about the horrific bombing that had been done on Cambodia at the time. It was a genocidal type of bombing. Kissinger had ordered everything that flies against everything that moves in Cambodia, and they attacked dams and attempted to and caused a great famine, which was responsible for a lot of people being killed. But that didn't appear in the news. What appeared in the news was there's this terrible thing going on in Cambodia, and it was terrible. It was terrible, but as you pointed out, there's a great consensus now that it was American aggression that paved the way for the Khmer Rouge to commit these atrocities that they committed. It certainly did.
Yeah. So
we see revisionist history. I mean, this is something right out of 1984.
Right. And this is something that the mainstream media, the corporate media, and they work so hard to appear neutral. Like this BBC interview, the very clean cut guy, nice suit, and language, way of speaking that is very official and so on. But if you actually study what the assumptions are against the facts, it's like you come to the conclusion that there's a very big gap between reality and the kind of stuff they report. And for those of you out there, listeners who are interested in understanding the in depth the lies of the media, I would recommend a website called Media Lens, which has been now on the internet for a few years, and it has excellent analysis. It's mostly of British media. In the United States, I believe there's something called Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. I don't follow them all that much anymore. I used to, but I haven't. But they're supposed to be pretty good, and I'm sure they still are. They still put out pretty good reports. But it's it's amazing because it's so easy. I mean, because we're surrounded by that culture, we're surrounded by that political environment, and even us dissidents are affected by it. And that's why I think it's very, very important to sort of have a knit sort of a intellectual community where we can exchange ideas and reinforce each other against and sort of protect each other against this onslaught of propaganda, which is it's like a if 24 hours a day, it's incredible. So
it is indeed.
Yeah, and
one great thing Chomsky's done for me is to make me more aware of these crimes that I had never heard of. Some of the crimes that have been done by our imperialist government are things that never crossed my desk before until I started reading up on his book, Failed States, What We Say Goes, etc. things I never knew. So
I may, and of course the classic study, which also goes into this Cambodia episode, is manufacturing consent, and of course even earlier is the Washington Connection and Third World Fascism, which had a second volume as well after the Cataclysm, and they both deal with the Vietnam War, Laos, and Cambodia, but you know, manufacturing consent, I think is the sort of milestone of their efforts. You know, they just very systematically analyze the media, and some of the sort of more basic understanding that we have today is due to that book. So I'll give a few examples. For example, the main propaganda technique is to have a very vigorous debate, very strong debate, but all within a certain framework of assumptions. So, you know, the right wing may actually say, talking about the Vietnam War or whatever, they may say, well, look, you know, we you're not allowing us to win. We could win and we fight harder. You're traitors for not letting us win. And then the left will say, well, look, we would love to win, but we can't. And it's too costly to ourselves. And, you know, a lot of our soldiers are dying and so on. But the assumption throughout is that, which both sides agreed on the same assumption, is that, you know, the United States has the right to invade other countries. The United States is pursuing a noble effort to, you know, do something good. Those are the assumptions that both sides share. He says that actually works better than the propaganda line, the party line in totalitarian states.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the people who crank out this propaganda are not there. They may be bad, but they are not stupid, and they have studied this, and they have a lot of experience in how to mold public opinion, and it's frightening to see how effective that they are. Mm-hmm. And you're right, we have to build up our antibodies against this propaganda, and that's one thing we activists can do for one another.
And I think that we've seen this confirmed on the internet over and over again. the role of reinforcement, and we all know what reinforcement is when certain ideas and certain habits are reinforced by two or more people, and that gives you tremendous strength. Of course, the reinforcement is not always used for good. We in our society, the beliefs that we have about the system, and our behaviors, and so on, are all reinforced, and a lot of those are not good for the world and for people. But and on the internet, obviously, we've seen the sort of cult phenomenon of you know, even though the internet can be an excellent tool, we've seen this phenomenon where it generates cults. It generates you put out an idea, then you get five people to agree with it, and then it's sort of like you get that effect where more and more people start adding up to that and joining that sort of movement, where you have some belief that is not grounded on evidence. But have you noticed that? Because you've probably seen the internet from its very beginning, how it has changed over time. And I think that's one of the more negative sort of aspects of the internet.
Yeah, there is no doubt that a false meme can catch on very, very quickly. The example of the lies that we were fed leading into the Iraq War is a pretty good example, where these lies were manufactured and amplified on the internet. One thing that's different about the internet than about certain other media is that people tend to go to the websites and listen to the news and seek out information that reinforces their own beliefs.
Right, right.
And this is a greatly polarizing thing because people become less exposed to alternate points of view or challenging or opinions and facts that challenge their way of thinking.
Yeah, because
that is a downside.
Doesn't that play into the into the whole thing about you know, because if you're seeking out stuff that you already know, say that, you've been, you know, if I mean, we know television is still the main avenue of information, the main source of information for most people, the corporate media. So we know that there's millions of people, just looking at the numbers, millions of people that go and see, you know, watch the CNN, watch Fox News on the internet, watch these mainstream websites, which of course have also the capacity to have more fancy layouts, more user-friendly layouts, which are, you know, it turns out that they're trying to convert the internet into a system where wealth will matter, and where people will be drawn toward certain sites and not others. And I think that that's, you know, and that's something that has been mentioned, and that is that a scientist, for example, doesn't read every single piece of literature out there on the subject that he's studying. He has a framework of understanding, and you know he couldn't live you know enough years to read everything that is out there, so he's got to select, and there's that framework of understanding that allows him to select pieces that are relevant to his field. And I think with the media is that if your framework has been so skewed by the corporate media and by, you know, the schooling system and by the by your work environment and by the people around you, when you're on the internet, you're going to tend to look for those things that reinforce those beliefs or those things that make sense. And So it's not clear that the internet you know decisively has to lead to dissidence. In fact, very often it doesn't. It has the potential, but it not necessarily leads you in that direction. So anyway, I want to remind the listeners that you can call in, and the guest call in number is 646-716-8106. Once again, 646-716-8106. So we're discussing propaganda here, and well, you, Eric, you've been working with computers for a while, and and I'm sure that some of the things that are happening today with the internet were already predicted, you know, back in the 80s and stuff, where this stuff was just starting to appear. Do you feel that has come true, that a lot of the predictions have come true?
Well, I'm trying to think of an exact prediction. One prediction that we had, I remember I was installing servers down in Brazil in 1994, 1995. I know I envisioned, and some of my colleagues envisioned, a Wikipedia type of thing early on. What we found was that there was more porno than anything else at very first. Predictions about it.
By the way, do you know what the percentage of porn is on the internet? I hear it's huge.
Terms of traffic, it must be huge, I imagine. You know.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know what.
Yeah, I mean, and that is sort of, I don't know if that was predicted at the beginning, but it's gotten so out of control, and I don't know if I know it's mostly catered toward man, but I think that that probably reflects some sort of something in our society that is a little bit skewed in terms of human relations and stuff, that there's so much reliance on that stuff. I don't know. It's hard to analyze.
Well, porno's been around a long time. I think of those stone Venuses that they find from 30,000 years ago in Europe. I think you know what I'm talking about. These corpulent little statues of women, and I think you know maybe that was an early version of porn 30,000 years ago.
Yeah, I think it's more. That's more erotic art because it's just like naked figurines. I actually have. I when I was in Pompeii, when I was in a town called Trieste, they were having a Pompeii exhibit from the you know, there was a volcano in Pompeii thousands of years ago, and so I had a little a magnet depiction of one of the frescoes, and it was like a porn thing for, yeah. So it's, I mean, it's been around for a long time, but it's just it seems to me that it's been sort of magnified on the internet. So I think I lost you for the last few seconds. I lost you there, Eric, right? You're not there. So I'm gonna keep talking and wait till he comes back. And so yes, I was talking about the internet in the context of the ideological system and how it's affected for the, you know, for the better or worse, a lot of the activist movements and interactions among people. And so some of the conclusions are that so far that the internet has you know, a lot of potential, but for good, you know, and in fact, apparently it's been used a lot for activism to I think it was in Indonesia, it was used to overthrow the dictatorship by organizing events through the internet. So a lot of those things are actually very positive, but others are not. So I think we have back Eric back on the line. Eric,
yes, back here.
I lost you for a little while there. So
yeah, I was cut off of it.
So yes.
It's a double-edged sword. We can use the internet for organization, for activism, to get to counter propaganda that's out there, to educate. We're also monitored every single bit that goes out there, every keystroke that you enter is monitored. You know, it's a huge it's a wealth of information for the powers that be. So you know, those are things to bear in mind.
Actually, there's someone on the chat room here. They're saying that I don't know if he's accurate about this. But if he is, it's pretty. He says traffic-wise, porn and spam are more than 90% of the internet. that's huge.
It's a sad indictment, yeah.
Right. I mean, society. I wonder, you know, if we had a sort of libertarian socialist society, whether that would change or go down a little bit. I mean, I think that some of our unhealthy sort of habits and. You know, spam, for example, is just an attempt to sell you something most of the time. So it's this emphasis on profit once again that is so corrupting at so many levels, and it affects you know, it just affects our personalities. It's very hard not to have a personality that's affected by your culture, your workplace environment, and everything else. I don't know if you heard about this guy. I don't know if we talked about it some other show. I don't know if it was with you but we were talking about some Canadian professor who was very impressed by the book Disciplined Minds. Have you read that book or no?
I haven't read Disciplined Minds. No.
Yeah, it's by someone called Jeff Schmidt, and he was basically a physicist. And. And he wrote this book because he said he was tired of all the ass kissing in his profession, which is of course very, very closely knit with the military industrial complex. And most of the physicists, he says that are very subservient but you know, it turns out this professor in Canada who read the book, he stopped grading his students. He said, "Look, this grading is not encouraging independent minds. It's getting the students to just follow, to try to please me and write what I think is right, and they have to go for what they think is right, for what they think is accurate." And he said at the beginning of the course, he said, I'm gonna give all of you A pluses. So he got in trouble. He got so apparently they he's been suspended and all these things. So that's been a sort of a struggle. I don't know how that is going with him, but you know, I think that more than anything, you know, the educational system. I mean, we go back. You know, everything is sort of connected. You know, the internet with everything else. But you come out of school, and even if in school you have professors that are, you know, not you know, mainstream, even if they're a little radical. I mean, the very structure of school, the fact that you have an authority figure and everybody's lined up and you follow orders and you know, and the teacher himself is a wage slave who has to do certain things, and the textbooks, especially in high school, are actually state mandated, so the teacher doesn't have a lot of leverage to do much outside of that. He's, you know, they're closely regulated. All those things definitely affect people's perception of the world, and
certainly does. Anyone who has a dissenting opinion or somehow doesn't fit in among the faculty gets weeded out. Chomsky is very clear about that. In any corporation or in the media, people may truly believe what they're saying to you because they wouldn't be there if they didn't truly believe the stuff that they were telling you. They get weeded out. There's a system to weed out people who think more independently or who have opinions that are inconvenient and don't fit in with the official the official version of things.
Right. I mean, in fact, I think he said that you can't be a good propagandist if it's not in your bones, because otherwise you give out secondary signals. It's like if you don't believe your own lies, you don't believe your own propaganda. It's you know, they're gonna find you out. You know, it's gonna be. I mean, some people are really good actors and they can fake it, but you know, also it's better. I mean, people usually have a conscience. You know, if you're lying all the time, you're going to have a hard time living with yourself. So it's better if you convince yourself that what you're doing is moral. So it's the old self-deception sort of a technique that is applied to justify all the propaganda. So I guess we're getting close to the half-hour show, a half-hour part of the show. So I guess we can take a break, and then we can come back and talk about some war news and other news. And I guess we can play some music. And I remind the listeners, if you want to call in, the number is 646-716-8106. So let's play Little Bob Marley here, and we'll be back in a few minutes. All right.
Okay.
By Bob Marley. So welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour, your favorite libertarian socialist show on the internet, and the number is 646-716-8106. Call in, ask questions, make comments. We're here to listen to you and try to express our opinion about the world and the problems that we're facing right now. So, Eric, you were talking about South America and some of the stuff that's going on down there.
Well, we're seeing a continuation of the same old story of imperialism in Latin America. We saw the coup in Honduras, which could not have happened without permission and complicity of the United States. There was this big hullabaloo a couple of weeks ago that Zelaya and Micheletti had come to some kind of agreement, but no. What they're doing is running out the clock, waiting for the election to come up, and this will, the election that will happen without having put Zelaya back in as a president, will validate, add an aura of legitimacy to the coup regime and to these elections. So that's really bad news, but not surprising news. But far worse than that is the agreement that Colombia has signed with the United States to put 7 military bases on Colombian soil. That's really disturbing. Colombia, right next to Venezuela, they've made a monster in the media out of Hugo Chavez. That's bad news indeed.
Eric,
the imperial footprint is...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, doesn't that sort of refute some of the perceptions out there that Barack Obama somehow, you know, being a liberal and stuff, that, you know, he's not, he doesn't support American imperialism?
Don't get me started on that. I call him Bush's little brother, you know. He's the singer in the boy band. You know, he doesn't write the lyrics. You know, he just delivers them and looks good on camera. But he's got powers behind him that actually call the shots. But these things in Latin America are nothing new. I'm reading a book right now. I'm getting through the Spanish version of it, but it's called The Brief Life of Brief and Marvelous Life of Oscar Wilde. It won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction back in 2008. But a lot of it is treats of the Trujillo regime back in the Dominican Republic,
right,
from 1930 to 1961, when he was assassinated by CIA, and the horrors that went on that island. So this is nothing new, and it goes back long before that. Latin America has suffered terribly from imperialism in countless cases. I won't even go into the catalog of it right now. But it's that's very typical of the treatment that they've received, and it looks like they're trying to heat that back up again, trying to heat it back up under our progressive president and our progressive party, indeed.
Yeah, I mean, I heard about the Colombia thing, and in fact, and you know, my documentary Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Politics, I show when he was invited to talk with Barack Obama, and this was recently, I think, you know, maybe 6 months ago or whatever, but it was right after a report had come out that the number of union leaders in Colombia murdered. It was actually the highest ever in the world for another year. I mean, Colombia has for a
yep.
long time had that sort of a record that of the most union leaders killed, and you know. So I showed, if I remember well, on the screen, I showed that, as well as that there was a deal for a base. Military base in Colombia there, and he was praising Uribe. I think that's the name of him, of the
Alvaro Uribe. Yeah,
right. He was praising him for his friendship and for his you know, how he was helping his people and in very difficult circumstances helping. I mean, it was so like apologetic for and that shows. I mean, you know, when people talk about how well, you know, they're pursuing certain policies because of human rights here and there. You know, in Cuba, we have this embargo in place because we don't like dictatorships. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, supporting Saudi Arabia, Uzbekistan, supporting Uribe in Colombia, all these places that have very, very poor human rights records, and so there is no. There's actually no double standard. There's a single standard of service to power and to elite interests, and that's a pretty good predictor, I think, of who the U.S. government is going to support in its foreign ventures.
Exactly.
Yeah,
They use a
and
code word, spreading democracy, which means wiping out democracy and making the pillage of the country open to corporate interests in the US and
Yeah, I think they said we're in favor of democracy so long as it doesn't interfere with our interests, right? So it's like, yeah, you can have democracy, but our interests are, we'll crush your democracy if it interferes with them, which it usually does. So.
It happened in Palestine and it happened in Nicaragua in the last couple of years, in the last few years. They had free elections, but oh, they voted for the wrong people. So the government of Palestine was declared invalid. It happened in Nicaragua where Condoleezza Rice warned the Nicaraguan people, you all vote the wrong way and there will be consequences. There will be consequences. And Nicaraguans remember very well what kind of consequences they're talking about with Reagan's terror war during the 1980s with the Contras, when so many tens of thousands of people were killed by U.S.-backed death squads. And they remember that stuff. They remember it better than people here in America do. So, we're here to spread democracy just as long as it's our democracy,
Right,
as long as you vote correctly.
So I guess changing subject here a little bit, there was a news item that I saw that was sort of interesting, and it's on Times Online, which is a British newspaper, and it says how the middle class are shoplifting to keep up appearances. As middle class shoppers who have been hit by the recession are stealing hundreds of millions of pounds of expensive food in an effort to maintain their high standard of living, according to a new survey. This quality cuts of meat, fresh fish, and high-priced cheeses are being taken by mostly middle-class women from specialty food and convenience shops, where thefts have risen sharply in the past year. Thousands of retailers have found that luxury foods are being stolen from individual use rather than to be sold on. The information comes from more than 42,000 shops in Europe, with combined sales of £262 billion, who were questioned by the Center for Retail Research. So, I mean, sort of like, this sort of fits in the, in my, once again, I keep plugging in my documentary, but I, the people that I interviewed were talking about how from the 70s on, there has been, I mean, of course, we live in a consumer society. People are used to consuming beyond their means. But from the 70s on, since there was sort of a stagnation of wages due to basically losing the class war, to put it bluntly, the people have been relying more and more on debt. You get your credit card, get in debt, get in debt to go to college. So you're always in debt and you're always repaying your debt. And sort of like when things go bad, it's like you're so used to getting your way, so used to consuming more that now that you're supposed to tighten your belt, right? Of course, the big cats don't tighten their belt. The big cats get bailouts. But the people are resorting. No, this middle class people, they don't want to give up their fancy cheeses and their nice cuts of meat and stuff like
And
that.
their status is what it is. They probably don't care so much about what exact food they're eating as much as the appearance that they can afford it, that they are doing okay in spite of everything else. So it's a vanity thing that's going on, and it goes back to conditioning, where people are conditioned by advertising and the garbage that comes through the TV set.
I remember
A loss of status is painfully humiliating.
Yeah, I mean, I think our society it has sort of and that's why, and when I did the article on wage slavery on Wikipedia, one of the things that I put on there is that, you know, in wage slavery, you're working not only under the threat of starvation or poverty, but also social stigma. You know, you got to work more hours because you don't want to lose status. I mean, losing status is sort of a you know, it's a big problem, and it's true. No one puts a gun to your head saying, you know, you can't, you know, go down the ladder, but we want to keep our consumption, because it's sort of like what Eric Fromm said in that book, To Have or To Be. He said, if you are what you have, then what happens if you lose what you have? You lose what you are.
It's very well put.
And that's what it is. So he actually, you know, he defines two stages. Two ways of being. And of course, all of us are somewhere in between. But you know, one is the being state, and the other one is the having state. And he says that, you know, of course, we should strive towards the being state. But the having is like, you know, always thinking, sort of like, you know, on a personal note here, I went on a date with this girl, and she sells suits. She sells suits at this place, in a fancy place where you know, she's, you know, very expensive suits. So, I mean, we go out to bars, and she's looking around all the time for men in nice suits. And she walks up to them, flirts a little bit, and then, like, says, hey, you know, come to my store. I sell this stuff. So it's always on her mind, you know, selling, because she gets a commission, you see. And it's sort of like, That's the mentality, and it's you know, it's just it corrupts the mind, you know, it really does.
It certainly does. It's nothing new. I think this has been around since mankind has been around. Who had more deer skins in front of their cave, you know, or you know, vanity is probably something that we evolved and might have had some survival value at one time.
I think what we emphasize is more the institutional aspect of it, where we may have a natural tendency towards some of that behavior, as well as some other behaviors, which are, of course, suppressed, like solidarity suppressed and all those things. But to whatever extent we have the tendency, it is hugely magnified by our capitalist market system. And so it doesn't reflect the best of humanity by any means, unfortunately. So
exactly, yeah. Yes, they've got the best psychologists and social engineers. They know how to manufacture consent. They're good at it.
Yeah, I mean the advertising is so pervasive, and the, you know, it's just the whole, you know, from the very beginning. I mean, in fact, Chomsky told Charnchi, who's our, you know, producer, that he found out that some of these high schools were being given textbooks by the Ayn Rand Foundation, the Objectivist Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, oh, there's and of course, and the teachers were delighted. You know, the regent, the person in charge of the school, because, you know, after all, he doesn't have to do any of the work. The objectivists take care of it, and they just hand the books. Look, this is for fourth grade or fifth grade or whatever. But it's all propaganda, and they're at an age where they're so susceptible to this kind of stuff. So they grow up, you know, having this really messed up concept of interpersonal relationships, where everything is about, you know, the selfishness and you know, the virtue of selfishness and all that kind of garbage. I mean, it's pretty awful. So yeah, I mean, I guess we could go back to some. I have some other news here. Have you been following they're sort of debating on whether to send you know, a certain number of troops to Afghanistan, and apparently there was a report that just came out. The top officials back 30,000 additional troops in Afghanistan, although I think McChrystal had asked for more. Did you hear about that at all? Or?
Well, yeah, that, it's pretty hard to miss that. What's interesting is to find the state of denial that people who voted for the current resident of the White House are in. This was an explicit plank in his campaign, was to expand the occupation of Afghanistan. There was no weasel wording like he did with Iraq and Palestine, this and that. no hope and change. It was an explicit campaign promise. So people who voted for him are going, wait, what's happening? We're so surprised. No, we can't let them get away with that, okay? They can't get away with that.
I would like to remind listeners as well of the origin of the Afghanistan war, because it's so, you know, it's so, I mean, it's assumed the Iraq was a quote-unquote mistake. There were no weapons of mass destruction. Although, of course, the purpose of the war, you know, getting a hold of the energy resources and a very strategic area of the world, that was the sort of, the real purpose, which is not mentioned at all. But Afghanistan is different in the sense that people assume that that's the quote-unquote good war. But it turns out that it wasn't. That the reason why Afghanistan was invaded was because the Taliban refused to hand over Bin Laden without evidence. Even under any conceivable law, you're supposed to provide evidence to extradite someone. What happened is that George Bush told the Taliban, we'll keep bombing you until you turn over to us people who we suspect are guilty of 9/11, although we refuse to provide any evidence. And it turns out 8 months later, Robert Mueller, who's the head of the FBI, was the head of the FBI, he said that after the most intensive investigation in history, that they thought that maybe part of the plot planned in Saudi Arabia, implemented from Germany, and so you had all these elements of the planning that were not at all clear. They had no solid evidence, and so the war in Afghanistan is also an illegal war. It was not a war that was sanctioned by international law. It was a war that furthermore put millions of people under threat of starvation. The New York Times reported that the bombing even before the bombing, 5 million people were close to starvation, and they were being sustained by foreign aid and stuff like that. And the New York Times reported that the bombing would actually increase this number by 2 million, and a lot of the foreign aid would have to withdraw due to the bombing. So it was a very immoral act on top of being illegal. So this myth about the morality of the war, about the legality of the war, about the righteousness of the war, and furthermore, it was predicted. I mean, on top of this, get this, it was predicted to increase the threat of terrorism. And that's exactly what happened. Afghanistan has been radicalized. The Taliban have gotten stronger. And they predicted that it could very likely have that effect, that if you attack that society, you would get more Islamic terrorism, not less. Not to say that the resistance is terrorism, because it isn't. Resisting a foreign occupier is not terrorism, but it does often entail terrorism, and that's often a byproduct of these kinds of state actions.
Yes, if I can add just one thing to that, that there is a geopolitical aspect of it too. The planned pipeline across Afghanistan to bring Caspian Sea oil to a warm water port, which would be Pakistan, that's been on the books for a long time. And a second geopolitical factor is that Afghanistan borders Iran. Look at the map. You see, we've got two occupied nations, one to the east and one to the west of Iran. Iran's boxed in, so it fits nicely into battle plan for the coming years.
Right, and I think that it also has to do with the fact that for many years Iran was sort of client state, because they had the Shah, who was after they overthrew Mossadegh, of course, they put in the Shah, and he was our guy, right? When the U.S. lost that, then they had to isolate Iran and circle Iran in whatever way they could. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of strategic interests that are, go beyond just, purely oil or this or that, although, the gas pipeline has definitely been a factor, and that whole area, you know, even before the United States, because the British tried to control that area. Even the Russians, of course, invaded Afghanistan. Although I don't know what the specific interest of Russia was in Afghanistan. That would be an interesting question to tackle. I'm not sure about that.
I could go into that in some length, but that might be for another show. I just had an interesting conversation with an Afghan friend of mine who moved back to Kabul. Just exchanged some emails with him and asked him about the difference between the Soviet occupation, which his family fled, and the American occupation. And he has some insights into that, but that may be good for another show. Cause I know
the Soviets actually constructed. They did some things like construct hospitals and roads and stuff like that. I mean, they apparently some of those are still being used right now. So I mean, they were as unjustified as their occupation was, they actually had some things they did that were better than what was going on right now.
It's very true. It's an involved question, and it has to do with Russia wanting a warm water port down to in which to export oil. That had
right.
something to do with it. But it's a bit complicated to go into it.
Right.
Time. Yeah.
Anyway, we have a caller, so I guess we can. Hello? Hello, caller? Someone there? Well, apparently the caller is not answering. So
can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now. Yes. Hello?
Okay, great. Yes. I was actually logged into the show right about the time you guys were talking about the internet, whether or not it was sort of another tool for propaganda, or if we could get some use out of it. And I thought I'd see what you guys think about sort of proprietary software and proprietary internet services versus open source or free software models. One of the things that made me think of it is I noticed that at one point your blog was on, I think it was Blogspot or Blogger. I think recently it was switched to WordPress, which is an open source free
right.
software application. So I'm just wondering if that's on your mind too, and if that kind of thing is something that concerns you.
Well, I definitely think that we should go in that direction. What do you think about open source software, Eric?
Well, I think open source software is. I use it whenever possible, wherever possible. I think it's a good thing. It is one thing that's important about it is that you can, if you can look at the source code that you're using, you can see if there are any back doors into your software. If you're running Microsoft Windows, who knows what's in there? Who knows what program is calling back home and sending information about you. I don't trust Windows or any other software I can't get the source for.
Right, and specifically with internet services, you were saying that, you know, every keystroke on the internet is basically monitored. A lot of proprietary or closed source pieces of software or services like Facebook commonly sell that information or use our content commercially.
Yes, they do.
By default.
Your chat room information, for example, is sold. And you can. There's a website called abika.com where you can buy a psychological profile of any person based on their internet usage. ABIKA.com. It's pretty frightening to check it out.
Right. I mean, And even YouTube, in fact, you know, there was a recent article written about how, as you probably noticed before, YouTube had the choice of the layout that it has now and the old layout. And I had the old layout, but it was just by default to change to the optional one. and a lot of people protested. But the reason why it was changed is because, you know, I think at first that you had a pretty low percentage of people who had advertising on their page. I think it's called AdSense. But now there's like over 20%. So there's a strong tendency toward advertising, towards commercialization. And that's obviously the advertisers want to know what you are, you know, what you're like, what your preferences are. I mean, you go to Amazon.com and immediately you're bombarded with whatever cameras or whatever items you were looking at based on what you were had been looking at before. So I mean, they do this all the time. And I mean, in this context, sort of in this along the same lines, we could talk about copyright. I mean, as you probably know, I've done a few documentaries or, you know, video montage type projects. Like, you know, I did The Evilness of Power, and I had some trouble using music that was copyrighted, and that makes it harder to actually show it on the internet as well. So you have to be careful with that. That can be used to censor you as well. So I mean, you just be careful of using the internet and Twitter. I mean, I have a Twitter account, never used it, but take say that anarchist guy who got in trouble at the G20 for texting to some of the activists through Twitter where the police were at. So that's a big worry right there.
I would wonder also if Twitter got in any trouble for that. I somehow doubt that they did. They probably got the lawyers to avoid it. But they actually claim rights to your data. It's on their servers. It is their data. I almost wonder if they have to take any responsibility for that.
Well, I mean, I have to say that, you know, I thought about, you know, because I've been unemployed for a while, so I thought, hey, maybe I can get some money through AdSense on YouTube, and I was going to do it, you know, or I thought about doing it, but I read the contract, and holy crap, I mean, that stuff was so tyrannical. I mean, the kind of stuff that they were claiming they could do with your stuff, you know, once you actually agreed to that. You know, most people don't even read that. They don't bother to read those contracts on the internet. You have like a whatever.
If most reasonable people read the terms of service, they probably wouldn't sign up for most internet services.
Right. I mean, it's totally tyrannical, and it's not. You know, it's not a freedom. It's not a contract between equal. We have no say in drafting that contract. It is like, you know, people would say, hey, if you sign a contract, you know, that's it. And no, I mean, the whole framework is skewed. And that means that until you democratize, you know, the means of production, you democratize businesses, you democratize the internet. And, you know, I think Wikipedia is sort of an attempt and to some degree, although that you do have some regulators now that are sort of preventing some of the democratic tendencies there. But you have you definitely have those tendencies toward commercial interest overwhelming the internet, and so I think we have to fight that.
All right. Yeah, that was my only question. I know the show's only got a couple minutes here, so that's it.
Thank you for calling.
No problem.
All right. So that was an interesting question, Eric. Do you want to close with any comments?
Yeah. Well, just it reminds me that an excellent website in Spanish called Rebellion .org, I think it is, was blocked from the Spanish language Wikipedia, and this is a legitimate website that carries articles from intellectuals all over the Latin American world, and a lot of translations into Spanish of Chomsky, of Zinn, and other people that we are that we know and love, and it was blocked from Wikipedia as being a spam site. Any Spanish speakers out there, rebellion.org, I think it is. It's worth giving a check
right
out too.
Yeah, I heard about that, but you know, it's sort of 90 like
seconds.
The sort of fight for legitimacy. You know, what is a legitimate website? What constitutes legitimate evidence? That's, you know, it's sort of being challenged right now, and maybe that's some of the positive influence of the internet, but only time will tell. So anyway, so we have about a minute left, and so I want to thank the listeners, and I want to thank Eric, and I want to thank everyone. And
well, thanks, Mr. 1001. I've always enjoyed coming on your show.
Thanks, and free, you know, I guess anyone can feel free to call during any of the shows, because we're here for to answer your queries. So we're going to close with some more Bob Marley, and we'll see you tomorrow.
All right.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Good night.